This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and in today's program, we mark the recent passing of polemicist Christopher Hitchens with proceedings from a Pacifica-sponsored debate between the author of God Is Not Great and Chris Hedges, the author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. The topic was religion, and the issue is now joined by Christopher's Hedges and Hitchens.
I thought of beginning at the end of where I would normally have begun, if that isn't paradoxical, and to reply to a question or observation that I get almost everywhere I go, which is, well, your book is right about saying that the holy texts are full of evil, hatred, bigotry, superstition, misleading ideas, all the rest of it. But why not think about all the people who are godly and faithful and spiritual and who, as it were, don't buy any of this? Well, I could not have written a book that was individually addressed to every person who cherry-picks religion or who decides that it's up to them to take it a la carte. I give you the example of a Baptist with whom I debated in North Carolina last week. I got him this close. I said, you're a Calvinist, right? He said, yeah, I certainly am. I said, well, do you think in that case that either I or anyone else in this room is going to eternal punishment for what they think? And he didn't like the question, I think for two reasons. One, as you know, people in the South are very wedded to their tradition of hospitality. It isn't considered polite in Dixie terms to have a guest to the Unitarian Church hall and tell him that he's going to be tortured with red hot pincers for eternity. But I didn't think that was the whole story. I thought that he didn't quite want to say it either. And in fact, I thought he probably didn't really, when he examined his conscience, which a faculty with which I was willing to credit him, didn't really believe it. But everywhere I go, they say, oh, but you say that Calvin was bad, but lots of Baptists are good. Now, let's make up our minds about this, I think. Let's not just feel, let's not just emote. Let us think and let us examine the text, because these are the only things that we really have that we can rely upon. Either this is the word of God or it's not. If it's not, it isn't. Well, either A or not A is a principle of formal and all other kinds of logic. Either it's moral, to move to my main point, or it is not, to believe this. And what I've noticed is that moral people refuse to answer to the precepts of religion when you confront them with it. People of ordinary ethics, and they say ordinary faith, will, when you ask them, well, why is there no hell in the Old Testament? Why is it only with Jesus that eternal punishment, the gentle Nazarene, comes into our lives? Is that what you think or believe? Oh, not really. No, he's a loving Jesus. He's a Jesus of love. Where do you get this from? What's your authority for it? I put myself out and say testable things, which I'm willing to be, will be, hope to be, need to be challenged upon. Why won't they do the same? If this were otherwise, I wouldn't have had to write or felt I needed to write this book. If it were the case that religion was a la carte and was another form of ethics, just another way of being benign or of giving money to charity or of being a philanthropist, then the following observations of mine wouldn't be true. Here are the observations. They're at random. You could add to them yourself. The parties of God in Iraq would not be trying to reduce Iraqi civil society to the level of pre-Afghanistan or post-Somalia, not by killing unbelievers, but by killing other Muslims. And there would have been by now a fatwa, either from the Shia authorities in Qum, or from the Sunni authorities at Al-Azhar University, so the supposed Vatican of the Sunni Muslim world, saying it is not in fact permissible, in fact it's condemned, to blow up each other's mosques, to kill each other's children, to destroy the societies, the families, the lives, the property of other Muslims. No such pronouncement has been made. They can't find it in themselves even to condemn that. People say, should I take the texts literally? I say, I don't know. All I know is what the texts actually say. If they can't use these for condemnation, where am I in this? Perhaps it will be found by the rabbinate of some Jewish community, Orthodox, Reform, or Conservative, meet and write to say that it isn't the case that Jewish settlers on the West Bank and Gaza hope by their colonization and theft of other people's land to bring on the Messiah and to make Armageddon that nice little bit nearer. That would bring about the end of days. Why don't we find that the rabbinate can find it in itself to condemn this? Though we hear that the Pope of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, the Mr. Ratzinger, as I always think of him, cannot but think of him, now says, after a great deal of rumination, that all those parents, for all those centuries, whose children were condemned to limbo because they had not been baptized before they died in childbirth, were in fact not there. It wasn't a real place after all. The hideous cruelty that the believing parents who thought, that's where my child is now, wailing, lost, forgotten, in limbo because I didn't remember the holy water in time before the death. The Pope should be able to say such a callous thing, such an evil thing, a wicked thing, immoral thing, and still be taken seriously as a man able to make pronouncements. And should say, well, we perhaps shouldn't have listened to St. Augustine on this point, but or on many others, such as the Holocaust, the Crusades, the Inquisition, the mass murder in Spanish America, the destruction of the Christian Orthodox non-Catholics of the Balkans and the Ukraine. We're ready to apologize for all that, but only so that we can be infallible all over again. This is not morally serious, and it's not my indictment of them, it is their indictment of themselves. A Catholic who says, you don't have to believe what the Pope says, I must inquire of them, to what extent then are you a Catholic, sir? By what authority do you repudiate this obviously evil, man-made doctrine? Well, that's why I begin at the end, because I want to anticipate, since I'm in Berkeley, California, the mush-headed view that there is, after all, a sort of spiritual background to this, an ethical character to it. I'm going to invite everyone, who have time too, because Mr. Hedges is ahead of me and I'm nearly halfway through my remarks. You've got lots of time to think about it. I want someone to get up tonight and say that they can name a stand made, moral or ethical, a stand of moral courage or political courage made by any religious person that could not have been made by someone who thought that the whole idea of God was ridiculous to begin with. Does anyone not understand the challenge? Okay. If by the end of tonight no one can do that, I think my point will have been carried. It is not the case, it simply is not the case that we get our ethics from religion or can derive it from holy men who believe they are interpreting the will of God and understanding his mind. It simply is not the case. Our morality, our human solidarity, our innate need to help one another, my wish, for example, that I can give a pint of blood to a fellow sufferer without losing one. My blood will be replenished. He will get a pint of blood, or she will, and I don't lose one. The pleasure I get from that is innate. It's part of my mammalian nature, which also makes me rejoice in the death of my enemies and the discomfiture of my foes, and even sometimes the embarrassment of my friends. I can't change this in myself. Neither can you. Pray as you may. You won't be able to change that about yourself. And I say to the Christians, while I'm at it, Go love your own enemies, by the way. Don't be loving mine. I think the enemies of civilization should be beaten and killed and defeated, and I don't make any apology for it. And I think it's sickly and stupid and suicidal to say that we should love those who hate us and wish to kill us and our children and burn our libraries and destroy our society. I have no patience with this nonsense. Well, that's my preface. I should say it's a great honor to be debating this with Chris Hedges. A couple of times I've nearly got killed in the Middle East by being confused with him. Greater dislike hath no man. The only worse experience I ever had was when I worked for the New Statesman in the old days, the English equivalent of the Nation magazine, the New Statesman, and was asking for an interview with the leader of the Falange Party, a Lebanese fascist Catholic militia, who, when he heard me say, "I'm Christopher Hitchens from the New Statesman," babbled into the phone to his genocidal boss, "This is important, it's Mr. Christopher from the New Testament." I'd rather be called Hedges than have that, but look, I'll make it quick. Religion comes from the stupid infancy of our species. I won't say race, because that was when we believed in race. We thought the species was differentiated by tribe. That's how stupid we were. And we thought God made covenants with particular tribes. Can anything be more hateful or ridiculous than this? And we didn't know there was a germ theory of disease, because we thought that leprosy and typhoid and bubonic plague were punishments. And we didn't know we lived on a cooling planet with a thin crust, so that volcanoes and earthquakes and tsunamis seemed like a judgment. And we didn't know that we lived on a round planet that went round a rather remote from the rest of the galaxy round star. Didn't know any of this. But they got in first, didn't they, the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews? They were ahead because, as you will know from your own experience, intelligent people, given what we have, pattern-seeking minds, will look for explanation even in the absence of evidence. And, as you also know, even smart people will prefer a conspiracy theory to no theory at all if the evidence is missing or is warped. And they got there first, and we have to live with what they told us. They told us that all of this was true, and that in return for regarding ourselves as less than the dust, as people born into original sin, as the Quran says, made from a clot of blood at a whim of God, or as the Christians say, from dust and mud, where even your lowliest rib will suffice to make that even lesser creature a woman, that in return for this masochistic, abject, eternally apologetic, guilt-ridden, fear of sex, hatred of the female genitalia, revulsion from the birth canal except as a one-way street, name me one god, including Buddha, who didn't come from a virgin, and see how unhealthy and unwholesome this masochism is, that in return for this abjection and shame, that we could be consoled by the thought that the whole whirling galaxy and constellation, the magnificence of the known universe, the entire extraordinary Milky Way, was designed with us in mind. The Me Galaxy. The You Constellation. And that God had a plan for us, or for me, or for you. So to compensate for the abjection, the subjection, the humiliation, the groveling, we can make you the biggest egomaniac that you want to be, because God has a plan for you. And he's ready to consider you as the heart of his creation. To fall for this is to degrade, I began with our ethics and our morality, is to degrade them even further. It's to say that a kind act done for a friend or a stranger can only be justifiable, can only be expected of you if you, or could not be expected of you if you did not hope either for a paradisical reward or a hellish punishment. That's why I call it poison. In our most intimate moments of love and solidarity and friendship, it's offering us either a bribe or a threat. It ruins everything that is part of the integrity of our species. And that's innate in it, no matter how much textual revision you subject it to. And it gives a wholly false impression of how the cosmos and the human species came about. You'll alert me, won't you, when I'm trespassing on the time of your... And that we don't have to put up with it. That it isn't a coincidence now. That, like my metaphor, my preferred analogy for this is Albert Camus, La Peste, the plague. If you remember the novel, at the end of it, the plague is over. The rats have gone back to the sewers. The city of Iran is healthy again. The bacilli have been banished or cured. But everybody in this city knows that the rats and the bacilli are back in the sewers. They'll always be there. They're ready to come out again, and as the novel ends by beautifully saying, to send themselves up to die again in a free city. You are never free from the threat of fundamentalism and religious fascism, because it's always licensed by the original texts and by the original misunderstanding, and it will always empower them. 10 years ago, I wouldn't have needed to write this book or wanted to, but today, try me. Try yourself. Turn a page of the newspaper. In Iraq, cradle of Mesopotamian civilization, the parties of God are set on a wreckage of the whole civil society. They would rather beggar and kill everyone than allow it to become a federal democracy, or even to experiment with it. His Holiness the Pope, I have to say something about him, says AIDS may be bad in Africa, but condoms are worse. People in this society say we insist on the stultification of our children by the teaching of pseudo-science. The Iranians have a tooth fairy god called the 12th Imam, a ridiculous, preposterous invention of an apocalyptic kind, and which we wouldn't have to care about except for late-night comedy, except that the same people who believe in this have managed by piracy to acquire an apocalyptic weapon to ram the lesson home. It's said by religious people to me that I must be a seeker, and that if I don't care about God, he cares about me. I turn it back on them. I say, you may think that you lived in a country, a society, a period emancipated from theocracy and superstition and barbarism, but you don't. These people are coming after you too, and it's time you woke up to it. Thank you.
Well, I certainly share Christopher's distaste with religious fundamentalism of any type, and I certainly do worry about American democracy and the threat that they, the very real threat they impose to it. But I think he's conflated religion with tribalism, and I think Hitchens sees only one form of religion, the chauvinistic, the bigoted, and the intolerant brand that was embodied in the idiotic pronouncements of figures such as the late Reverend Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson. He assures us in his book that religion spoke its last intelligible or noble or inspiring words a long time ago. It may speak about the bliss of the next world, he writes, but it wants power in this one. Religion is a product of the bawling and fearful infancy of our species, and all attempts, he assures us, to reconcile faith with science and reason are consigned to failure and ridicule. It's easy, increasingly popular, to attack this childish belief system. But by doing this, we refuse to deal with the nuances and depth of religious faith. Hitchens ignores in his book the great moral and ethical struggles by theologians and religious leaders such as Tillich or Karl Barth, who have attempted to root religion in contemporary society. He never confronts the anguish faced by millions of believers around the world who recognize the impulses we carry within us for evil as well as good. And I think he's unequipped to deal with religious belief, trying vainly to argue against its authenticity. He writes in his book of Dr. Martin Luther King that in no real as opposed to nominal then, sense then, was he a Christian. He disparages the faith of Abraham Lincoln and assures us that Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor, was put to death by the Nazis for resistance, was the product of a religious belief that had mutated into an admirable but nebulous humanism. This is a cheap way to avoid the harder task of exploring the wide range of religious experience, of examining the motivations and beliefs of those who come out of a religious tradition and strive to live the moral life. He's determined to demonize religion, and he would have us believe that self-professed religious leaders such as King or Bonhoeffer were not really religious. And in this, he is in fact an ally of the very religious bigots he denounces. The sophistry of this argument mirrors the sophistry of those who misuse the Bible to champion Genesis as the factual account of creation and to persecute homosexuals, Muslims, women, artists, intellectuals, and those they brand with the curse of secular humanist in the name of God. The problem is not religion. The problem is religious orthodoxy and the form it takes in human institutions. Most moral thinkers, from Socrates to Christ to Francis of Assisi, eschewed the written word. Once moral teachings are written down, they become, in the wrong hands, codified and used to enforce conformity, subservience, and repression. Writing freezes speech. George Steiner calls this the decay into writing. Language has turned from a living and fluid form of moral inquiry to a tool of bondage. The moment the writers of the gospel set down the words of Jesus, they began to kill the message. There is no room for prophets within religious institutions, indeed within any institution. For as Tillich knew, all human institutions, including the church, are inherently demonic. Tribal societies persecute and silence prophets. Open societies tolerate them at their fringes. And our prophets today usually do not come from the church, but from our artists, poets, and writers who follow, as I believe Socrates and Jesus did, their inner authority, an authentic religious impulse. Those who deform faith into creeds, who use it as a litmus test for institutional and personal fidelity, root religion in a profane rather than a sacred context. They seek, like all who worship idols, to give the world a unity and coherence it does not possess. They ossify the message, and once ossified, faith withers. There are many theologians, including Tillich, Barth, and Reinhold Niebuhr, who brand the version of religion Hitchens attacks as idolatry, as false and dangerous. And he's right in going after this form of belief. He's wrong in assuming that it is religion. What he fails to acknowledge is the supreme importance of the monotheistic traditions in creating the very concept of the individual. This individualism, the belief that we can exist as distinct beings from the tribe or the crowd, and that we are called on as individuals to make moral decisions that at times defy the clamor of the tribe or the nation, is an important gift of the Abrahamic faiths. This sense of individual responsibility is coupled with the constant injunctions in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity for a deep altruism. And this laid the foundations for our open society. This individualism is the central doctrine and perhaps the most important contribution of monotheism. We are enjoined, after all, to love our neighbor, not our tribe. This empowerment of individual conscience is the starting point of the great ethical systems of our civilization. The prophets, along with Jesus, helped institutionalize dissent and criticism. They initiated the separation of powers. They reminded us that culture and society was not the sole prerogative of the powerful, that freedom, and indeed the religious life, often required us to oppose and defy those in authority. This is a distinctly anti-tribal outlook. Immanuel Kant built his ethics upon this radical individualism. And Kant's injunction to always recognize that human individuals are ends and do not use them as mere means runs in a direct line from the Christian Gospels. Karl Popper rightly pointed out in the first volume of The Open Society and Its Enemies, when he writes about this empowerment of the individual versus the crowd, that there is no other thought which has been so powerful in the moral development of man. These religions, in a very real sense, set free the critical powers of humankind. Believers in the Bible and the Quran were called to embrace an abstract, universal deity. This deity could not be captured in pictures, statues, or any concrete, iconographic form. God exists in the Word and through the Word, an unprecedented idea in much of the ancient world that required the highest order of abstract thinking. In the beginning, the Gospel of John reads, "Was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." This is why the second of the Ten Commandments prohibits Israelites from making concrete images of God. Iconography thus becomes blasphemy, Neil Postman wrote, so that a new kind of God could enter a culture. God, as Hitchens notes correctly, is a human concept. God is the name we give to our belief that life has meaning, one that transcends the world's chaos, randomness, and cruelty. To argue about whether God exists or does not exist is futile. The question is not whether God exists. The question is whether we concern ourselves with or are utterly indifferent to the sanctity and ultimate transcendence of human existence. God is that mysterious force, and you can give it many names, as many religions do, which works upon us and through us to seek and achieve truth, beauty, and goodness. God is perhaps best understood as our ultimate concern, that in which we should place our highest hopes, confidence, and trust. And I think God is better understood as a verb rather than a noun. God is not an asserted existence, but a process accomplishing itself. And God is inescapable. It is the life force that sustains, transforms, and ultimately defines existence. The name of God is laden, thanks to our religious institutions and the numerous tyrants, charlatans, and demagogues these institutions produced, with so much baggage and imagery that it's hard for us to see the intent behind the concept. All societies and cultures have struggled to describe these forces. It is why Freud avoided writing about the phenomena of love. It is by the seriousness of our commitments to compassion, indeed, our ability to sacrifice for the other, especially for the outcast and the stranger, our commitment to justice, the core message of the prophets, that we alone can measure the quality of faith. This is the true meaning of faith. As Matthew wrote, "By their fruits shall you know them." Professed faith, what we say we believe, is not faith. It is an expression of loyalty to a community, to our tribe. Faith is what we do. This is real faith. And faith is the sister of justice. Those who silenced Jesus represented all human societies, not the Romans or the Jews. When Jesus attacks the chief priests, scribes, lawyers, Pharisees, Sadducees, and other blind guides, he is attacking forms of oppression as endemic to Christianity as to all religions and all ideologies in all institutions. If civil or religious authority enforces an iron and self-righteous conformity among members of a community, then faith is transformed into ideology. Faith is not in conflict with reason. Faith does not conflict with scientific truth, unless faith claims to express a scientific truth. Faith can neither be affirmed nor denied by scientific, historical, or philosophical truth. And here I think Hitchens confuses the irrational, which he sees as an endemic part of faith, with the non-rational. There is a spiritual dimension to human existence and the universe, but this is not irrational. It is non-rational. Faith allows us to transcend what Flaubert said was our mania for conclusions, a mania he described as one of humanity's most useless and sterile drives. The sole reliance on reason, faith in human reason, allows us to ignore the dark Freudian undercurrents that lead to self-worship. And it leads to a dangerous form of idolatry, a form of faith, certainly, but one most of the biblical writers knew led to evil and eventually self-destruction. Hitchens states that the whole record will show, first, that person for person, American freethinkers and agnostics and atheists come out the best. He assures us that someone's secular or free-thinking opinion would cause him or her to denounce injustice. This assertion, coming from an apologist for the war in Iraq, for the crime of aggression committed by the Bush administration in our name, is, to say the least, rich. The danger, which I think Hitchens fails to see, is not Islam or Christianity or any other religion. It is the human heart, the capacity we all have for evil. All human institutions, including religious institutions, with a lust for power, give their utopian visions divine sanction. Whether this comes through the worship of God, destiny, historical inevitability, the master race, a worker's paradise, fraternité, égalité, liberté, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. And religion is often a convenient vehicle for this bloodlust. Religious institutions often sanctify genocide. But this says more about us, about the nature of human institutions and the darkest human yearnings than it does about religion. His book finally externalizes evil. And when you externalize evil, all tools, including violence and torture, become legitimate. This is an assault on what he defines as the irrational force of religion. But once we begin this assault, it permits us to sanction the abuse and subjugation of others. This is done in the name of another particular version of goodness, the goodness of reason. But this too is a false god, an idol. Once you wage unprovoked wars and embrace torture, you unleash sadists and killers. You consign other human beings to moral oblivion. You become no better than those you oppose. Hitchens does what fundamentalists do. He embraces a self-serving and, I think, finally simplistic view of religion in the world. And this allows him to create an illusion of a binary world of us and them, of reason versus irrationality, of the forces of light battling the forces of darkness. And once you set up this vision, it becomes possible to view anything that will subdue what is defined as irrational and dangerous as necessary. Necessity, William Pitt wrote, is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. Thank you.
Of course, I want to start out by asking you, Christopher Hitchens, whether you believe that secular institutions
have the same history of violence as religious ones.
I don't have the white noise ability to invoke faith as my opponent does, but I will remind you all, ladies and gentlemen, that I offered you a fair bet at the beginning, and I included my opponent, as I now think of him, in the wager. Can you name a moral action committed by somebody in the name of their God or their church that you could not have committed yourself? And I'm still waiting for anyone to get up and say, this could only have been done by faith. And I'm still waiting for him to say so too. I'll make that point. On not your point about the secular, or the secular atrocious, I care about it enough to develop a whole passage, a whole chapter of my book to it, available, by the way, at fine bookstores everywhere. I am still a materialist. In this form, you can be an atheist and a sadist, or a nihilist, or a fascist, or a communist, but it's not necessitated, because you don't invoke supernatural aid for your view. You don't say, I'm doing this because God makes me do so, thus you have to do so too. You take your chances. Put the case, if you like, since it comes up all the time, of Joseph Djugashvili Vissarionovich, the Georgian despot, in Russia in 1917. Millions of Russians for hundreds and hundreds of years have been told, without any contradictory evidence, that the head of their state was not just an absolutist despot who owned everyone and everything within the borders of Russia, but that he was also the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, and if a little below the angels, a little above the common human level. That was their model, and that's what they believed. If you were Joseph Stalin, you shouldn't even be in the dictatorship business if you can't exploit a pool of credulity and servility and stupidity that has been left to you like that by your Christian predecessors. You're not, and he'd been a seminarian all his life, remember. He would think, this is too easy. I can stage an inquisition, which he did. I can stage a heresy hunt for heretics, which he did. I can offer miracles, which with Lysenko's pseudo-biology promising three a harvest a year, he also did. I can find out who Satan is working with within the borders of our wonderful dominion easily, and I can print it in Pravda. The whole thing is a horrible simulacrum of what had been left to the abandoned, despised, ground-down Russian people by their education in Christianity. Now, if there's to be a level playing field, which I know that my opponents don't wish for, I want to be told how it is that any society that follows the precepts of Lucretius and of Spinoza and of Galileo and of Russell and of Voltaire and Jefferson and Paine and Einstein has ever fallen into the same pit of ignorance, famine, cruelty, stupidity, hysteria, witch hunting that is the special privilege of the faithful. So that's my short answer to your question. Let's try that for an experiment and see who comes out better.
Chris Hedges.
Yeah, I mean, I hate institutional religion as much as Christopher does.
You prefer an individual.
But I think that, you know, and this is something that numerous writers, you know, from Dostoevsky, I mean, even Beckett, I think in some ways is a deeply, probably the most authentically religious writer of the 20th century, in understanding the kind of morally neutral universe in which we live, and that need for interconnectedness, you know, that mystery that surrounds us. And all societies and all cultures have struggled to give words to this mystery, this transcendence. That is the religious impulse. Of course, there are many people who have done what I would define as deeply ethical acts that don't come out of a religious tradition. But I think, and again, going back to the Tillich quote, I think, you know, all institutions, as soon as belief systems become institutionalized, they become, in Tillich's words, demonic, that institutions seek their own power and their own self-perpetuation. And I think what we're doing here is confusing the very dark history of religious institutions and that fusion of religious iconography and religious language with the iconography and language of nationalism, a frightening and toxic mix is throughout history, and certainly something that we both saw in the Balkans, from that authentic religious impulse, which is palpable within human society. It's real. It's why, science or can study sexual urges and lust, but it fails finally when it tries to study love. It's why even Freud himself gave up and quite publicly said it was something that he couldn't grapple with. And I think that's what we're dealing with. I especially coming out of the church, I have a great deal of anger, and maybe even more anger in some ways than Christopher does, towards the bigots who wrap themselves, in the American flag and clutch the Christian cross. But I think we do have to make a distinction between those impulses that I would describe as religious, essentially non-rational, and religious institutions.
Christopher Hitchens, you praise in your book the rationalist legacy of the Dutch Jewish philosopher Spinoza. Yet Spinoza was a pantheist. He believed that the universe and nature are inhabited by some kind of abstract divine force. Do you see any harm in this sort of spirituality without God?
Not really, I don't, because Spinoza, who I suppose you can still call Dutch Jewish, was in effect neither Dutch nor Jewish. He was excommunicated viciously by his synagogue and changed his name to avoid further identification. And his greatest emulator, Albert Einstein, followed him in saying that the whole idea of a personal God or a God who intervened was not just ridiculous, but detestable. Such a person is obviously not going to tell me that I can't have a ham sandwich, or not that I particularly wish to retire to a motel with Mr. Hedges after this is over, as if to make up our differences, as it were, rediscovers what was noted rather sapiently by Epicurus and Democritus well before any Abrahamic tyranny had imposed itself on us. How they knew this, I don't know. I'd love to know how they found it out, but that the world is made of atoms, and that if there are any gods, they're much too smart to involve ourselves in our sordid little quarrels. So, as someone who says, I feel spiritual, and I'm okay and you're okay, I find intensely boring. But if they're not going to try and tell me that their views must be taught in my children's school, or that their views must be legislated about stem cells or contraception, or that stultifying crap must not be taught in the schools under the name of intelligent design, I'll agree to avoid them and they can go off and bore someone else. And though that's not the greatest lesson taught by Spinoza and Einstein, it's still a very important one. But there isn't a Christian or a Jew or a mono, or an Islam, or a Muslim who can make you that promise. They can't. They will not leave you alone. and turn any page or open any page of any newspaper today, and you'll see that they find the authority for bullying you and lecturing you and trying to intimidate you in their holy texts. And why wouldn't they? Because in those man-made texts, that authority for the punishment of apostasy or infidelity or womanhood or sexuality or free thinking is already there, just like the rats and the bacilli in La Peste, just waiting to be revived by the turn of a page. Please, know an enemy when you see one.
We're not in disagreement on this particular brand of, you know, what of religion, for lack of a better word, although I look at the Christian right not as a religious movement anymore, but as a mass political movement, probably the most frightening mass movement in American history. It's easy to beat up on people who embrace a non-reality-based belief system. It's easy. I think it's important to recognize what it is that drives people into the arms of these demagogues. And in that sense, I have a little more compassion than I think Christopher does for them. It's despair. It's economic and personal despair. We live in a country that is rapidly becoming an oligarchy. A corporate state, the top 1% in this country have amassed more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. Writers on democracy all the way back to Plutarch and Thucydides understood that you cannot sustain a democracy in an oligarchic state. We have whole sections now of the United States that resemble the developing world. Only 9% of jobs are in manufacturing jobs, the lowest point since the Industrial Revolution. State and federal assistance programs have been slashed. Communities are boarded up wrecks. And these people have lost hope. They've lost hope not only for themselves, but for their children. There's been a kind of Weimarization of the American working class. There's a pernicious assault on the middle class. Anything that can be put on software can be outsourced, is being outsourced. And when you create those inequities and in disparities, you push people into the arms of demagogues who promise them a world of magic and miracles, that Jesus will walk with them and protect them and take care of them and has a divine plan for them. And I detest these people as much as you do, but I don't detest the followers who we as a country have betrayed. And I don't define that as religion. This is a totalitarian movement. Totalitarian movements often cloak themselves in religious garb, and religious institutions have a long and terrible history of willingly embracing these movements. But that for me is not religion, nor does it express a religious impulse.
And I'm here to tell you that this message concerns our love. The angels must have sent me to deliver this to you. Now hear me now, brothers and sisters. Which we measure our pain. I'll say it again. God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yes, we do. I don't believe. I don't believe in I-Chi. I don't believe in Bible. I don't believe in tarot. I don't believe in Hitler. I don't believe in Jesus. I don't believe in Kennedy. don't believe in Buddha. I don't believe in mantra. I don't believe in Gita. I don't believe in yoga. I don't believe in tea. I don't believe in Elvis. I don't believe in Dylan. I don't believe in the Beatles. I just believe. Drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. I believe that somewhere in the darkest night, a candle glows.
And that concludes today's program, featuring a debate between Chris Hedges and the late Christopher Hitchens, produced by Pacifica Station KPFA on June 6, 2007, courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives. We also heard a rare acoustic version of John Lennon's God, the Young Rascals singing I Believe, and the Love and Spoonful's Do You Believe in Magic? This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. With thanks to Michael G. Haskins for engineering, we welcome your leaks, suggestions, tips, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. We also wish you happy holidays, if indeed atheist secularism allows the very word holiday, eliding as it does the phrase holy day, from the old High German heilig, referring to things holy, sacred, or divine, or in the original Proto-Germanic etymology, healthy. For 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.